This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For centuries, the thought of a literary tradition among Iranian women was unthinkable, indeed suppressed. Still, since the middle of the 19th century, a number of pioneering women have defied that tradition and gone on to produce poetry and novels of the highest quality. We'll meet one of those women today, an internationally acclaimed author of 15 books published in Iran. That's later in the program. But first, a holiday tradition that is the largest of its kind in the country and one that has held Charlotte in its grasp for 47 years, the Southern Christmas Show. Let me give you some figures. 250,000 square feet or 6,000 acres or six football fields of nothing but holiday cheer. It runs for 12 days, and this morning they are in the middle of that run at the Park Expo and Conference Center out there on Independence Boulevard. We wondered how such a thing could not only endure but grow as it has since 1968, and we wondered about the economic impact this show has had in all of that time. So we invited Joan and David Zimmerman to join us. Joan is the founder and CEO of Southern Shows. They produce more than just the Christmas show, and her son David is president of Southern Shows. Welcome back to both of you.
Good to be
here.
Thank
you. Nice to have you here. How did this all started? The Southern Christmas Show, I believe, started in 1968.
It did.
How? Why?
It started as a three-day show, and we decided we wanted all of the bazaars in the city to come under one roof at one time. We accomplished that, and we grew to 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, but the show kept expanding beyond the bazaars, so it was that was the first idea, bring the church bazaars together. What's also interesting, though, is, since you're a historian, is that the first show that we ever had was so simple. It filled less than 80,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. Did not fill Independence Hall.
That still sounds big to me, John.
Well, it wasn't that big. and it was only 3 days, and our big attraction that year was a Christmas Day float that had a red pedestal with the world's largest fake diamond, and that was the big attraction. So people were a lot easier to please then.
And in 1968, I hesitate to ask this, David, how old were you?
Yeah. I was seven and sweeping floors, I'm sure.
Okay, all right. That was your job.
I still do that, by the way.
Now, you and your husband, Robert, started all this.
We did.
What did you do before there was a Southern Shows?
Well, you know, we actually founded the company in 1959, produced
really?
Our first spring show in 1960, and have expanded since then. Prior to that, Robert was in his father's business of electronic fences. I had worked in PR and advertising and marketing for John Harden Associates in Greensboro. Mm.
Where did the idea come from for that spring show?
Well, the idea came from a friend of John Harden's who came in and said, we need a fantastic flower and garden show in North Carolina. We can do it better than they do in New York. And John said no, and I said, I'd like to try. Mm-hmm. And the rest, as they say, is history.
This is my perspective, so it could be completely wrong, and if it is, correct me. But you produce lots of shows. It's not just the Southern Christmas Show. It's the Southern Spring Show. Is it still called the Southern Women's Show?
It is, except in Michigan.
Okay. And you produce them all over the country, but the jewel in the crown seems to me to be the Southern Christmas Show. Is that, in fact, the case?
That is the case.
Okay. Is that the show that made this an empire for you, this Southern Shows? It's an empire.
Empire, but it is.
Well, you work all year on these shows. They never stop.
We do, and but it is certainly our most popular show. We'll have well over 100,000 people come over those 12 days, and that's why it's 12 days long, because it takes that long to get so many people there.
And because, as we all know, there are 12 days to Christmas.
Oh, well, that is.
So about 100, I read that the it got to 140,000 people at least 1 year. Why do you think the Christmas show, and is this the only place you do the Christmas show?
It is.
Why do you think it does so well? What is it about Charlotte and Christmas and this show? Because this thing is a juggernaut.
David should probably answer that.
It kind of goes back to the beginning in 1968, and most really great events around the country started small and grew. And that's what the Southern Christmas Show did, and the fan base grew, and the size of the show grew, and it kind of kept growing on top of itself. And it's, I often tell people, I think if we didn't produce it, it would produce itself at this point. It's gotten to that point that it's just self-sustaining.
What's interesting to Charlatans and probably you is that the first show we produced, Paul Buck came from next door at the Coliseum, walked in, and he said, "Who in the world will ever come and pay money to see something like this?" And we thought, wish he were alive today.
Not everybody can be a visionary, I suppose, about everything. But every year, you say it could run itself, but every year you change it up. It's not the same show every year. There are lots of similar elements because this holiday is about tradition. And so there are things that are there every year and people who are there every year. But you change it up every year, too.
We do change it up. I tell folks at our company, we want to be like the circus. So if you go to the circus, you know there's going to be three rings and there's going to be certain things. But every year, the circus brings in something new. And that's what they promote. And that's kind of what we do. We want it to be the same but different.
How big a challenge is that? Because in the spring show, you can do almost anything you want to as long as there are flowers somewhere in the show and things to get ready for spring and summer. But Christmas is so steeped in tradition. People don't like things to change.
Not much.
Christmas.
They especially don't like to come and not find their old favorites at the show. So we always have the decorated trees, mantles, doors. We always have a fabulous entrance that puts them in the Christmas spirit.
And the strudel.
The minute they come in. We always have the strudel. We always have the smells and aromas. We always have choirs and entertainment. So it's and it is tradition, and it is making people feel comfortable. And what happens, we stand at the front and really wonder, looking in amazement, and we see people walk in, and they're like, wow. Those who have never been before, it's like, wow.
Well, I remember the first time I went. It's pretty overwhelming. You don't know what it, you know, you don't know, if you've never been, you don't know what it is.
We remember the first time you went. You complained the whole time.
I did not. Did I really?
Yeah, you did about the crowds and the traffic and the...
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding. I have a very good memory, Mike.
Well, I humbly apologize. Well, I believe at that time...
Your former life.
In my former life.
Yes.
I believe that I was doing... Weren't we doing daily shows for weeks on end?
Yes.
Rainbow.
Well, you should be thankful that I didn't come last Saturday, because evidently you had a severe challenge with traffic from the race that went right past you and the event in the Coliseum. How do you develop these new themes every year? Is it you? Is it exhibitors? Do you contract this out? Do you have staff that decides this year the theme is going to be and we need to build this exhibit?
We make it up. We come up with something different every year. This year is all aboard for Christmas, so you come in the show this year. We have an animated train and just something different. And what happens is our exhibitors get a hold of that, and they'll do little train themes. And last year it was, oh, what fun it is. So we change it up every year just to have something different and give us something to talk about.
But do you guys do this? I mean, for instance, with All Aboard for Christmas, did you decide that's going to be the theme? Let's go find a train. Or did you find a train and decide what's the theme going to? Okay, we'll call it All Aboard for Christmas. How does that work?
I will admit we were clearing out files and I found some artwork from 1976 and it was a train. We said, well, this looks good. Let's use this again. They probably don't remember from 1976. So.
Why would they?
So it worked well. So
everything old is new again. What goes around comes around.
But we do at this show. We'll decide. Pretty much what we want to do next year.
Right.
At this show,
we'll decide what we want to do next year based on the reaction of the guests to the show. Like, what are you looking for? And they'll say to us, oh, we missed so-and-so. Oh, we loved the year you did the boxes. Yeah. Oh, we loved the year you did the windows. So we'll work around that and come up with something that they're particularly interested in.
How do you get that feedback? There are 140,000 people that come through this show, and there's only two or three of you. So how do you get that feedback?
Well, Mike, there are 40 of us now.
Really?
We've grown.
We are at the interest every morning. We're talking to people. And we do surveys, of course, but with a lot of us just talking to people. And believe me, these women, and it's 80% women that come to the show, they are serious about this. If things aren't the way they expect it to be. They'll let you know pretty quickly, so you don't have to necessarily ask. And they'll tell you what they like and what they want to see.
I read an interesting figure yesterday. It actually surprised me, and that is you say that only about 20% of the show's attendees come from Mecklenburg County.
That's correct.
Where do the other 80% come from?
About a third come from the county surrounding Charlotte, and about another third come from the Carolinas, and the rest is beyond that. 5% of our audience is not from the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, or Tennessee.
Which makes an additional economic impact on the city.
How do they know about this show? If you're living in what do you know the farthest flung place somebody has come from in the continental U.S. for this show? Do you have
We have one. She actually happens to be an airline stewardess and or attendant, so she comes from Washington State every year.
So
she's a free flight, so that maybe that doesn't count, but she does come, and I see her every year.
But we also have the snowbirds, and they will plan their trip from the north to go to Florida so that they come through here while the Christmas show is going on. So we have the snowbirds.
This show is always ended right before Thanksgiving. It's always ends Sunday before Thanksgiving. And we've done that on purpose because folks come to the show and they want to get their new decorations for their houses. And a lot of folks decorate during Thanksgiving. But what happens is Aunt Mildred from Akron will come down to visit and, you know, they'll see their family and then they'll head back before Thanksgiving. But and they come because they know the show's going on. So,
and then the snowbirds come back from Florida during the spring show.
Well, we're a little early for them, actually. We're going to have to do something about that.
When do you start working on this show every year?
Now?
So you're working on next year now?
Yeah, absolutely. We're thinking about next year now. We watch how the traffic flows through the show. We watch what people are particularly interested in. We ask them what is missing this year that you'd like to have next year. We work on it now.
This is the largest show of its kind. I mentioned it's the largest Christmas show in the country, but there are other Christmas shows in the country. But this is the grand poobah.
It is. Go
ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say there's probably a Christmas show in every town and village in the United States, but the larger ones in San Francisco, Indianapolis,
Houston,
yeah. But this is the largest by the number of days, the attendance, and the square footage inside. Now, there are Renaissance festivals, as there is here, that covers more ground, but we are the largest show of our kind in the country.
Why? I mean, Houston is so much
bigger. Because we do a great job.
But Houston is so much bigger than we are. Why wouldn't they have an enormous show if it's successful and it's run for a couple of years?
I think part of that has to do with what we just talked about, is that if we just relied on Mecklenburg County, there wouldn't be that – it would be a lot of folks for sure, but it wouldn't be a huge attendance. And all these towns around, the Hickories and the Kannapolis and all those folks, that's where a lot of our audience comes from. And they come to Charlotte, and a lot of them spend the night and come 2 days. And
well, I was going to ask, do they come 2 days? Do they stay overnight? Do they eat in the restaurants? Or do they just come and eat the strudel and go home?
And we'll have as many as 30 buses in a single day at the show that will come with 50, 60 people on board, and they come from all the towns around. So it's really become quite a phenomenon. And I'm wondering why we don't ask for subsidy from the city. What do you think?
Well, I think you should probably go back to the city and tell them in a very stern voice about last Saturday. But that's a show. That's another show, not this one. Joan Zimmerman and David Zimmerman are both with us. They're the founder, CEO, and president of Southern Shows, the Southern Christmas Show in progress, even as we speak, at the Park Center through the 23rd of November. I have a couple of more questions about economic impact and things like that, but they'll have to hold until after the break, so stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Cancer Care, offering multidisciplinary clinics where breast, prostate, GI, and lung cancer patients receive a comprehensive second opinion from a team of experts. Details at 704-384-5373. And James McElroy and Deal, for over a half a century, providing legal services and counsel to individuals and businesses, jmdlaw.com. Coal ash is controversial, you may have noticed, and so is the North Carolina Coal Ash Commission. They were sworn in last Friday and wasted no time in deciding that the cost of cleaning up Duke Energy's coal ash ponds will fall to Duke Energy customers. Meanwhile, the governor and two of his predecessors are suing the legislature over the makeup of the commission, and there's more to talk about, and we will, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Washington is coming under increased fire for failing to lift the 50-year-old trade ban with Cuba. As Cubans struggle with a devastated economy, many say now is the time for change. Debate over ending the U.S. embargo on Cuba.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Southern Christmas Show, the largest show of its kind in the country. It's in its 47th year at the Park Center. Joan Zimmerman, who created it along with her husband Robert, is here, and her son is here as well, David Zimmerman. He's the president of Southern Shows, because they produce a lot of different shows, and not just here in Charlotte, all over the country. You kind of, I would say, invented this. I mean, there were probably other dinky little shows around the country, but you kind of invented this, and you talk about analyzing the traffic patterns through the show, and not just this one, the shows you produce elsewhere, to try to figure out what you did right and what you could improve and what you should do the next time. No one taught you how to do that.
No, just practical common sense. You figure out how things work, and then you try to see how they would work better. But it is true, when we produced our first show in the South, there were no consumer shows as we produced them anywhere in the South. They were in New York, they were in Boston, they were in the large northern cities, but nothing here. So there were no benchmarks for us to work with. It was just an idea, and explaining to people
What it is,
we had one retailer who will go unnamed. We called on, showed him the floor plan, showed him the booths all laid out. He said, "I get it. It's kind of like a cemetery, and you sell off all the plots."
Oh, my God.
We said, "Well, we hope it will be a bit more exciting
than that."
And part of that is that there weren't any buildings in the South until that time.
I guess we should point out that the Park Center was the Charlotte Merchandise Mart,
yes,
which at the time was what? The biggest building of its kind in the...
Absolutely, yes. It was 80,000 square feet.
Except for the Greenville Textile Hall,
okay,
which was not available for consumer shows.
Okay. So that's why it's here and not Atlanta or some other place?
Mm-hmm. And we love it here. It's great.
Who built the Merchandise Mart? Is that a city project?
Dwight Phillips. It's always been private. It was owned by the Phillips family, and now, of course, it's owned by Park.
Right. So this has become, if you go on your Facebook page, you can tell that this has become a thing among the people who come back year after year after year. Because not only do you get into the Christmas spirit when you walk through the doors, many people are already in that spirit before they even get into their cars to come. Talk about that for a second.
Well, it's kind of become a little bit of a cultural phenomenon. The women dress up and they'll have on their Christmas garb and their antlers and all that, and they have fun. And we actually, I'll show you, obviously radio, you can't see this, we hand out merry money, you can have that,
thank you,
which is
so
worth
much.
$5. So if we see somebody really dressed up and having a good time or just having fun, we'll hand these out and they can spend $5 in the show.
This is
the kind of fun things we do.
This is a page out of the Disney book.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do that at Disney World, too.
They found it from us.
All right. That's good. Let's talk about the economic. We talked a little bit about the economic impact. But this show, at one point, and I may do this every year, I don't know, brought in something like, I'm trying to find it in my notes, $25 million. Is that right? $25 million. Show sales at the show have topped $25 million. How much of that stays here?
Certainly a great deal of it. Now, obviously, a lot of our vendors at the show are from out of town, so that money goes away. But a lot of it stays here in Charlotte with local
taxes.
Folks. They're paying a lot of sales tax, absolutely. And again, all of our exhibitors from out of town are spending the night in a hotel for 12, 13 days. So
not only eating.
and eating. So the impact on the city is really huge. It's a little bit unnoticed, I guess, because it's not a convention like the Shriners coming to town or something like that. But it does bring the people.
But it is, yeah. I mean, do the Shriners bring 140,000 people to town?
No.
I mean, really, do they?
Also, every exhibitor who comes into the show, and we have over 500, and most of them are from outside of North Carolina. They have to buy a North Carolina license, and they have to buy a city license to sell. So that is additional revenue that comes into the city. So it has a great economic impact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I read that that retailers in the area use the Southern Christmas Show as a barometer for what holiday sales will do. I'm not sure that I understand how that works, but maybe you can explain.
Well, they would call David, or they would call me, or they would call our office. How did the show? Oh, they would ask their exhibitors or their people who've been in the show. Like Belk has an exhibit in the show. How did you do at the show? Well, they exceeded last year's sales by 20%. If they take the 20% because it's an impulse buy and it's only 12 days and the excitement of the season, they'll usually then say, well, our sales should be up by 10. So they'll half it. Mm. So if it's 7, 3%, yeah.
And that's because people come to the show specifically in the mood to do what they're going to do.
Specifically, and they're from outside of their market area, so they know they're not going to get them back to their particular store.
I've said already that the Christmas show is the big kahuna, but is it? I mean, is the attendance at the Christmas show that much higher than the spring show or the other shows that you
produce? Oh,
yes,
absolutely.
It is? Yeah. Then why only do it in one city? Because where do you do the spring show? Here?
Just here.
What do you do elsewhere in the country?
Women's shows, home shows. David has created or expanded a huge mammoth farm show.
We produce a major agricultural show for the Carolinas, Virginia. All the farmers come. It's more of a trade show.
Yeah.
So we do different types of
shows.
So
if this is so successful, and it is, why not take it elsewhere?
Well, it's actually we've
you'd kill yourself doing it, I'm sure.
Well, it really one part of it is it really needs to happen right before Thanksgiving, and just trying to produce two of these in two different places, we just decided, especially with we have a 40,000 square foot warehouse full of props that we drag out and put up every year for this show. So just the logistics is doing something like this somewhere else would be.
Where do you store all this stuff?
Right down here on North Tron Street, we have a nice warehouse.
So, what has come back this year that seems to be the most popular thing from years past, and what about this year's show seems to be striking people's fancy?
Good question.
The gift of the season seems to be food, which we have in abundance at the show as gift items, everything from peanuts to honey to bundt cakes, anything you need in the food area you can get. Christmas ornaments, the blown glass, the handmade crafts, everything that is unique at the show and about the show is what's popular. They've also been asking about, and I believe David's the one they've been asking, about the windows that we brought in several years ago. We bought them from New York. Animated, fabulous. So, yeah, they want what they've seen before.
How long can this go on? How long
can Christmas go on?
You have found a never-ending show to do.
Yeah.
Have you started working on the spring show yet?
Oh, yes. It's all the gardens are sold out. It's
going to be a theme for that this year. It's going to be Carolina Calling. We're going to have a lot of Carolina-type themed gardens and things to do with North Carolina. Should be fun.
Well, good luck with it. And the Christmas show goes until the 23rd of December at the Park Center, which used to be the Merchandise Mart, which is on Independence Boulevard, before it gets nasty.
And we're open till 9 every night except tonight when we're open to 6.
All right. Joan Zimmerman and David Zimmerman, thank you both for being here. And happy holidays to
you. Thank you. And to you.
We're going to completely change gears here now. For women in the Middle East, a writing career has been, for many, out of the question. Cultural and religious customs simply prohibited female participation in the literary world. Still, that prohibition did not stop women from writing and publishing, and often at great cost. Many of these women have made significant contributions to literature in that part of the world and helped to broaden our understanding of life in the Middle East. And I want to point out Asia, because Iran is actually in Asia, not the Middle East, but areas of understanding life for women in those parts of the world. One of those writers is our guest for the remainder of the show, and I hope that I do justice to her name. Muniru Ravinipur is one of those writers. She's an internationally acclaimed writer, author of 15 titles in Iran, including collections of short fiction and novels. She will be in Charlotte to be the featured presenter at the UNC Charlotte International Education Week, and she joins us by phone in advance. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you. And also with us in our Spirit Square studio is Rebecca Joubin, the Malcolm O. Parton Assistant Professor of Arab Studies at Davidson College. She studied in Syria for a decade and is the author of The Politics of Love, Sexuality, Gender, and Marriage in Syrian Television Drama, and translated Muniru Ravinipur's novel Afsane. Is that how you say it?
Afsane.
Afsane.
And what does that mean?
It means legend. It's the name of the protagonist.
Okay. And also with us is Jaleh Abedini, who was born in Tehran and is the former secretary of the Iranian Student Organization at UNC Charlotte, where she is also a chemistry major. Welcome to you as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with Muniru. According to a 1995 New York Times article, for the 10 years leading up to 1995, Iran's best-selling fiction lists have become dominated by women. Further, it reported, women's books are outselling the men's by far, thanks to simple, and some critics say simplistic, language and compelling personal narratives, often delving into once taboo subjects like romance and sex. First of all, do you agree with that statement? Is that true in your mind? And has that trend continued, if it is true?
I'm so sorry. I didn't get you. I didn't hear you clearly.
Oh. Well, I'll say it again. The New York Times reports in 1995 that for the 10 years leading up to 1995, the best-selling fiction in Iran has been written by women and outselling literature by men by far. If you agree with that statement, has the trend continued?
Bestseller writer for women and readers were almost mostly 90% readers were women. But this is after Ahmadinejad came and did a mess, then there is no really any opportunity for women. Independent writers to publish their books and their story, their fiction. So every year, our country has its own problem. Every year, even sometimes every second, everything is changed.
Well, let's talk about that, because prior to the Iranian Revolution, when the Shah was in charge of Iran, women had rights. They had freedoms that they don't have under this current regime. And as you pointed out, the current regime is not really the current regime. It has changed over time. There's Ahmadinejad, there's the leader now. There have been several Ayatollahs, I believe, who have been in charge of, who have been supreme leaders. Has the impact on women substantially changed in those years since the Iranian Revolution? And in terms of those changes, have things gotten worse or do they get better for a while and then get worse again?
Absolutely. You see, we suffering and struggling is our habit, is a part of our body, our soul, especially for Iranian women. And we were always involved in every event, every movement in our country, but we didn't get any opportunity. We always lose our opportunity, our right. Even after constitutional revolution, when revolution established constitution, then the women went for asking their right and asking a kind of equality, but they didn't give to them. Mm-hmm. So they go and make a secret society, a group for themselves, secret society ladies. We were always a struggle, and I think we will, because it is not about only our country. It is about that location, Middle East, our tradition, our custom.
Now,
it is not new. It is not new, you know. Sometimes some of our tradition is from 6,000 years ago, not only 1,000 years ago.
Now, I understand that among in your 15 novels and your other works, that the themes that you write about are women's unequal status in Iranian society and the reasons behind it, and you criticize male domination. That sounds like an almost impossible thing to do and live to tell the tale within Iran. Would that be accurate?
I didn't get you again. I didn't hear you again clearly. I'm so sorry because of this.
Okay, voice. That's all right. I'll ask the question again. The theme of your books has been the unequal treatment of women within Iranian society, and one of the reasons behind it. And you criticize that reason, which is male domination. If that's an accurate summation of many of the themes in your book, how have you been able to write those books? Because you weren't always in the West. You began writing in Iran. How were you
after
able
revolution.
To do that?
No, after the revolution. I began writing after the revolution. When revolution has happened, then I start writing. But before that, I was writing my journal. But anyway, you know, gradually, they pushed us on the corner. They didn't eat suddenly. When they got over, we were all in the street. We helped them unconsciously. We didn't know that. We are trying to get power from the Shah and giving them to this Islamic Republic government. We didn't know. We have our own goals. Mm. But writing this kind of a story, okay, you know, after revolution, I start writing, and I publish one short collection of a story, and then they immediately banned it. After that, I start writing for myself. I start with Saltanat, daughter, Nasreddin Shah's daughter, you know, 100 years ago, she wrote her memoir for herself without any hope or any goal for publication. But I started writing for myself, and I was in my private. I had my privacy, so I don't care about the results. But those days, they didn't kill those days. When I started writing, they didn't kill writer, or they didn't. Water writers, they just randomly arrested and put the people from the into the jail. They didn't do anything with the parties almost in those days. But you know, I wrote for myself. Then after war, when war finished, I could publish some of them.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break. When we come back, I'll get some perspective from our guests in the studio here at Spirit Square as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Person of Interest on WBTV Channel 3. Tonight's original episode is at 10, followed by WBTV News at 11. Reporting facts, getting answers, finding solutions. WBTV on your side.
And support for Charlotte Talks also comes from the historic Green Park Inn in Blowing Rock, listed on the National Historic Register. This 123-year-old manor hotel offers unique holiday celebration packages for families and friends. Reservations at greenparkinn.com. Washington is coming under increased fire for failing to lift the 50-year-old ban on trade with Cuba. As Cubans struggle with a devastated economy, many say now's the time for change. Debate over ending the U.S. embargo on Cuba coming up in just 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. When we come back, more about the impact of women in the Persian and Arab world through literature. Stay with us.
Eyewitness identifications can be wrong.
People think that it's sort of like a photo in their mind, and it's just not.
But eyewitnesses in court can bring convictions.
Often at trial, they're completely confident. That's the one. I'm 100% sure. I'm 120% sure, even.
Proposals to make eyewitness testimony more accurate. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In advance of the Century of Literature by Iranian Women event at UNC Charlotte, part of UNC Charlotte's International Education Week, on November 21st, this event will take place at McKnight Hall. We have one of the leading female writers from Iran with us by phone, Muniru Ravanipour. She's the author of 15 novels, including in English, The Drowned, Heart of Steel, Gypsy by the Fire, Legend, which was translated by one of our other guests in the studio today, and that would be Rebecca Jumain, who is the assistant professor of Arab Studies at Davidson College. She translated the novel Afsana. Mm-hmm. Say it again in Iranian.
Afsana.
And also with us is Julie Abedini, former secretary with the Iranian Student Organization. I'm massacring these names, and I apologize for that. You translated the novel that Muniru wrote, and much of the theme of that novel covers what we were just talking with her about, the oppression of women in Iranian society, etc. Talk about some of the themes in that novel that you translate.
Okay. I think the novel's important precisely because it's not just about female oppression, and that's why it's been banned. This story is it doesn't fall into the stereotypes of Iranian women. We have a strong woman writer. She's in her 30s trying to carve her own place in her society, and as she's very interested in history and trying to figure out fact from fiction within her own history and Iranian background, she's also trying to figure out and sift through fact and fantasy with her own childhood. We get references to traumas from childhood, the Iran-Iraq war wounds that she has from that time period. There are references to a marriage and that she escaped on some lost night that she described and is then indicted by society, and we don't exactly know why. And so we have this untraditional narrative style, this sort of an unsentimental examination of mental illness. And we have, so as a result, this writer, this very strong woman who's dealing with her own demons. She's got a dictator pushing her, the character pushing her in one direction. She's got a horseman pushing her in another direction. And these characters from her novels are all popping before her. And what I think makes this novel very important is that, yes, this is within a framework of oppression as a woman, but it's deeper than that. It's about the tragedy of the human condition. And some of the most visual scenes are of this writer in her own capacity. Now she's been oppressed, but when she's in a position of power. So we have her working in a publishing house, and when the secretary approaches her, this young woman who really idolizes her, and finally gets up the nerve to say that she has a novel that she's written. The way in which Afsana belittles her, crushes her, is just it's horrible, and it's this, and it continues throughout the novel when other young writers present their works. How all of a sudden, in this position of power, she also can crush and hurt these writers' dreams. And so, what I think is important about this novel is, and in my discussions with Muniru throughout as we were doing the translation, is that it's not necessarily a feminist novel. This is about the human condition, the tragedy of the human condition, and dictatorship and how it can crush the human soul.
And is that why you say that this novel rises above stereotypes?
There's a problem, I think, within the Middle East, and, you know, now we're talking about Iran in particular, but an act of protest in one in that context. With you know, these writer these novels are not decorative; they're not commercial. They're strongly politically and socially charged. And so, the problem is that when we transfer them from that context, where they're trying to make a change, there's a message in their own society, and we bring it to the West, where there's an uneven power dynamic and there's a politics of production. These works can sometimes be used to enhance stereotypes, to degrade that culture more, to make it less human. And this is a fundamental problem. This is why I don't think every single work should be translated without a proper introduction and placement within context. Her work rises above that.
Well, there are many things that don't translate. Mm-hmm. There are many terms in language, idioms that don't translate. There's just no way to say it in English, and that's the case in any translation from any language to another language.
Exactly.
But there are also things that people in the West don't know mm-hmm. and don't understand mm-hmm. about Iran mm-hmm. or other countries in that part of the world. We just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So how, when you're translating a work, mm-hmm. do you have to go in and fill in those blanks, or do you just translate what's on the page in Iranian to mm-hmm. what's on the page in English?
Well, there are different philosophies with translation. Mine is probably more liberal in the sense that I'm constantly making decisions. And so, for example, even with idioms, as you were talking about, and different ways of expressing things, there are some who would say that if you bring in some of these idioms, you may be othering the culture. Whereas I find languages and cultures are all very beautiful. And so what I tried to do in the translation was sort of bring a balance between Persian words that I brought within the text and then define them within the text, some of the larger expressions, and having a glossary. And I felt that bringing the reader into Iran, into the expressions, because there is so much humor in these idioms and in these expressions that I think that get lost in our media. When we talk about Iran, we are constantly talking about the negative. But looking at the language and these idioms brings a whole different dynamic, I think. So I do try to keep the terms. And I was very lucky to be able to also have good communication with Monuru during the process.
How did you work together on this?
So when I first started translating it, I did it. It was years ago. I was a PhD student, and she was in Iran still at the time. And so I found her contact and just basically asked, you know, can I translate this novel? And she agreed. And then I worked on it as a student, and then I came back to it several years ago. And when I came back to it several years ago, she was in California, so I had much more direct access. And she, I would call her sometimes, and we would talk about certain passages. There's a challenge in Persian in the fact that for the pronoun he or she, it's u. And so when she has many conversations, and with the characters from her novels popping before us, we've got this dictator and the horseman, and we've got her own interior monologue and this character of a woman writer. And so sometimes it's impossible to know the u. And there were many in one paragraph, and so I'd call her about those. And what really helped me as a translator and was a gift, I think, and it shows Moniru's generosity and humility, is that she constantly reminded me as I was translating it that she would say, "This is your think of the translation as your own work, and your own interpretation is welcome, and you have the freedom for that." And so that gave me the ability to take certain liberties and feel comfortable.
So, Munira, you speak English as well as Iranian, as well as Persian, rather. So you've read the translation, I take it. Did she do a good job?
Yeah, I appreciate her translation, and she is one of the best, actually. It's very difficult to translate from Farsi to English, because it is not only about the word. Always there is a culture beyond the word. So because she is familiar with Farsi too, she did a great job. And thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you so much.
Jule, you're the youngest person in the room. You're a student at UNC Charlotte. You were born in Tehran. When did you come here first?
2007.
So you were how
10
old?
Years. I was 23.
So you had lived as a young woman in Iran. What was the first thing that you noticed that was different about this country? The first thing that maybe shocked you left you with your mouth open going, why did I come here?
Well, I was born in Tehran, and if you haven't seen the pictures of Tehran, you see it's a huge city. So I live in Concord, actually. So when my sister picked me up, we went to her house, I'm like, oh my God, I'm living in the middle of the woods.
That's right.
And so many squirrels. So that freaked me out. I was like, why are there so many squirrels around this town? But then I got used to it and getting to a point that I actually like the quiet city. Every time I come to like downtown Charlotte, I'm like, oh, traffic. Yeah. I don't get it.
We're talking a minute ago about stereotypes. And people in the West don't understand that culture because our exposure, first of all, we've been closed off from it for a number of years because of political situations. What are the stereotypes that you hear among your fellow students about that part of the world and about the lifestyle, the culture of that part of the world that you wish they would understand?
Well, when I was in coming to college, it was a guy that he was like, oh my God, you're so lucky you're still alive. I'm like, what do you mean? I said, well, I heard that they bury girls alive. I'm like, where did you hear that first? And second, if that was happening, it was not in Iran. It was in another regions of Middle East. And it was like 1,400 years ago. And people still think this stuff is common in Middle East. And the other thing was like, I can't believe you can speak English. Could you even go to school? I'm like, yeah, we could go to school back there. It's not like that we were not allowed to have education. It's just like, it was a little different way of living in Iran compared to United States and the way the girls are here compared to the way the girls are back there. Although it's changing in Iran a lot too, because we have social networking, we have more access to the Western program, media programs than even me had as a child. So people are seeing how the other parts of the world are, and the girls are changing too.
And Doctor, you've done research on gender dynamics in the media and on film, and I mentioned that you looked into how sexuality, gender, and marriage are depicted on Syrian television. Now, Syria's in turmoil right now. I'm sure that's changed a bit since you did your research, but what did you find?
Basically, again, stereotypes that, you know, in that part of the world under a dictatorship that, you know, there's a victimization, this idea of victimization. And in the book, what I tried to show is that, on the contrary, from the 60s, in terms of television drama, as soon as it was established, was highly politically critical, and how they use metaphors with regard to gender constructions and marriage in order to critique the government. And so, and each time period from the 60s, there was a lot less interest in sort of in women. It was much more a focus on the suppression of men and in order to critique the politics, in order to show men not being able to get married, men not having an economically feasible life. All of this was critical of the government that put them in this position. And there was a lot of fear of strong women that would arise by the man being so downtrodden. This changed then, you know, throughout time, and a lot of emphasis even on gender relations and the inequality in gender relations, and this being sort of grander metaphors for political critique. And so I found it, and what I found interesting was it wasn't necessarily women writers that had more access to the world of women and were more sensitive. There are quite a few very important male writers who were able to enter the world of the woman with just as much sensitivity, and this, I think, is very important for gender dynamics.
Munira, there is censorship in Iran for both men and women writers, which makes, I guess, the life of a writer difficult, although some people seem to be able to overcome that, among them you. But in countries like Iran, where censorship is in force, are there topics that are simply too dangerous or too taboo to write about?
Of course, you can't write about sex. You can't write about love. No, they banned one of my books, Satan's Stones, because I wrote about a dancer and a prostitute. And it's up to the situation. You know, for a while they don't let you to talk about love, and for another year they don't let you to talk about the government, for another year, and they change. And but love and sex is taboo, and sexual relationship, we don't have this kind of scene in our story, in our fiction at all. And even we couldn't write about it. really move from our mind all this activity.
Julie, you've lived in both countries and both cultures, and I don't think one is better than the other. It's just they're very different.
It's different.
So now that you've been in both cultures, are there things about the West and the permissiveness of the West on television, in the movies, in literature, that you're uncomfortable with?
Well, the over-sexualization of women, I'm actually really uncomfortable with it because every music video you see is about women's body and sex. Even on media, we all saw what Kim Kardashian did this week.
Right. Actually, I didn't, so that's okay.
You have your morals. Thank you for not seeing it. It was bad. So actually makes me really uncomfortable because at the same time, you want to give this image that women are powerful, women can be president, women can get on the top, but at the same time, the media just over-sexualize everybody.
So,
especially women.
So, and since you read Farsi,
yes.
I take it, and you read English, and
yes.
I'm sure that you've read some of Moniro's
yes.
works. What are the things that female writers in Iran are now being able to say to give a new voice and put new ideas into literature?
Well, since this new era that women are more contributing to the literature, and I see it, it's more passionate what women write compared to what men write, and you see it in the literature and stories and poems also. And comparing to the men have a structural mind, but women's mind is like a fluid, and it's more passionate, it's more sexual, it's more sensual the way that women write about it. So when a woman is talking about a man hugging her, it's different from a man saying, "This woman got hugged." That's how it is. She films the warmth, but in men literature, it's just like, okay, she got hugged.
And you say, Doctor, that a lot of what's being written in the popular press in Iran is about relationships, mm-hmm. motherhood, marriage, childbearing, and those things actually would challenge Western stereotypes of Iranian culture. I have 15 seconds. Can you tell me how?
Well, even right now...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Right now we're talking about the impossibility of depicting love, for example, and I think that this is the stereotype that we have in the West, but in the films and in literature, I've actually seen that it's the opposite. I've seen a culture of defiance when they're able to express.
Dr. Rebecca Juban from Davidson College, Jelle Ebedini from UNC Charlotte, and Moniro Ravinipur, the author of Legend.